Hey, and welcome to FutureThinkers.org, a podcast about the evolution of technology, society, and consciousness. I'm Mike Gilliland.
And I'm Yuvia Ivanova. If you're new to the show and you want to get a list of our favorite books, popular episodes, and to join our community, go to FutureThinkers.org/start. All Future Thinkers episodes are now on video. To watch the premiere of each episode and join the discussion live, subscribe to our YouTube channel at FutureThinkers.org/YouTube.
Check out our new course in personal evolution. Part 1 is on cultivating sovereignty and is designed to support you in developing more clarity about your direction and purpose in life, making better decisions, and having more agency to live your life on your own terms.
Part 2 is on integrating the shadow and is designed to support you in overcoming nihilism and tapping into an inner source of energy, creativity, and wisdom to make meaningful progress towards actualizing your full potential. To learn more, go to courses.futurethinkers.org.
Hey guys, welcome to, I think we're on 97, right? 97. So we got three more until we're at 100. It's taken us like 5-6 years to get to 100 episodes, and Joe Rogan's on his like 100th of his MMA in just a few months. Have you noticed that?
Oh no.
And he's on something like 2,000. I think he's getting closer to 2,000 now. That's insane. I don't know how you put out that much content. I'm like brain dead after every single one of these. Okay, so we've got our group call that happens every week, and to do with the course. If you're not familiar with all of this stuff, check out episode 96, because I think we explain a lot more about
it. Talked about it a bit at the end, yeah.
So we wanted to expand on this idea of sovereignty, especially mental sovereignty. Mm-hmm. And we ended up talking about this quite a lot on the call today. It just happened to be the subject of the call. So where do you want to start with this?
Well, one of the things that comes up is that sovereignty is not really something that people get taught in school. In fact, they get taught the opposite, which is why sometimes when you actually try to guide people to becoming more sovereign, they resist a lot because they've been conditioned to act completely opposite of sovereignty. So what this means is that people expect to have an authority figure that tells them what to do. They expect to kind of have a parental figure that supports them and tells them, you know, you did well or you didn't do well. And a lot of the time they just externalize kind of their own decision-making, wisdom, insight, any number of things. Even income, you know, when we think, oh yeah, I have to have a job, I have a boss, like somebody that you're reporting to. It's also kind of a modified parental figure in a way that provides resources for you. And all of society is structured in such a way that there are all these different institutions that for your whole life basically expect you to give up your sovereignty. And so school obviously is a proxy for the real world and for the corporation. So schools don't teach people how to be sovereign. They teach people how to
follow instructions.
Yeah.
Be a factory worker.
Exactly. And so when the subject of sovereignty does come up when people are already adults or supposed adults, it's often very, very contrary to everything that they've been taught. And a lot of the time it's even unconscious. They don't realize that they're doing it. But I've noticed this. It's really a big, big difference in thinking when you stop deferring authority to other people and start realizing, okay, actually, I am the highest authority in my life. Wow, what a difference. Mm-hmm. Nobody can tell you how to think. Nobody can tell you what to do. And it doesn't mean that you have to be a selfish asshole or that you never learn from other people or you never listen to other people's opinion. It's just at the end of the day, you are the authority on you.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is amazing how much the subject comes up about people needing a teacher or a guru or some sort of like guidance, handholding through the process of either becoming an adult or waking up.
Yeah.
This has been a subject that's come up and definitely came up quite a bit today in the call. Mm-hmm. So I think we've kind of glazed over a bit of the definition of sovereignty because a lot of people who haven't heard us before might be thinking we're talking about like, you know, being a sovereign individual in the context of the new sovereign man movement, or they might be thinking this has some weird connection to being a sovereign state. So let's define what this actually is.
Okay. So the sovereignty that we're talking about is in the same sense that Jordan Greenhalgh talks about it. which is your capacity to be a conscious agent in the world rather than be reactive or kind of defer authority to others. And so there are three elements to sovereignty in this framework, and that's clear perception. So you actually see what is going on in the world without judgment. You're just able to observe it. Then perception, then sense-making, which is your capacity to make sense of what is actually going on, to understand it, to be able to kind of take different perspectives or switch different frameworks. And then finally, it's agency. So it's your capacity to do something about the situation or not do something, to be able to control basically your response, that you're not automatically doing something.
A new one that came up for me in agency was the systems and mechanisms of having agency in our modern world. So to me, agency, I mean, as I've previously been thinking about it, it related a lot to, what do I do about information that comes in? What do I do about things that I can or cannot have control over? But I think when we think about this in a more modern context, we can start to think about like voting mechanisms, participation mechanisms, group organizational mechanisms. So like the decentralized autonomous organizations, DAOs in the blockchain space, that's a really great example of how people are now inventing mechanisms of cooperation and consensus at scale. And this all has to do with agency. Mm-hmm. But let's step back a bit to the sense-making thing, because that, I think, is something people have a difficult time separating it from perception, for one. And ideological possession happens quite a bit at the sense-making level, because people latch on, they feel they've been red-pilled, woken up to some new sort of system or framework or ideology, and that new ideology becomes their primary sense-making mode. Right, without realizing that that's just one chunk, that's one perspective, one viewpoint at how you can look at the world and make sense of what you're perceiving. Mm-hmm. And we have all kinds of meta conversations about how we as a couple are interacting with each other on a sense making or a perception level. We don't really talk about agency a whole lot, but like we do talk about how, if we get into an argument, where the corruption of sovereignty took place. Mm-hmm. Are we perceiving each other right? Are we like ping testing each other that we understand each other from the you know, each other's perspective? And that all relates to the sense-making aspect. Yeah. So I think sense-making is probably the most difficult aspect to unpack here.
Well, yeah, I would say especially at the stage that our society is currently.
Yes.
There's probably the most corruption at the sense-making level. Yeah. Because people, on average, have quite a lot of agency these days. And as far as perception goes, well, there's actually a lot of information out there.
It's almost too much. It's an overflow. Mm-hmm. They perceive too much, and they don't, because they lack proper sense making, they're unable to decide on the filtering mechanisms that should be applied all the way back to perception. So what information should I take in? What should I consciously be taking in, and what should I be ignoring?
Yeah.
Which is, you know, it's a cyclical thing with agency and perception. Yeah. But without a proper sense-making model that helps you decide what is the most important thing that I need to focus on, you end up just casting a very wide net and taking in everything, which can be really unhealthy. Mm-hmm. Especially since so much of our access to information is pre-filtered echo chamber kind of messaging, right? Like other people have been bouncing ideas around in their singular little meme tribe, and not letting it bounce out to receive criticism, or at least when it does receive criticism, they just put on blinders and ignore it. And then that kind of gets filtered through to you, mm-hmm. who have indicated to the Facebook algorithm that that's the information you want to get, or YouTube or whatever. So you end up not getting a lot of like varied opinions from conflicting meme tribes. And that really fucks with your sense making.
Yeah. And it's also that there's a breakdown of meaning in our society. So in the past, you could say that meaning was a lot more externally given,
yeah.
by structures like traditional gender roles, by
religion
huge, cultural, national identity, that sort of thing. So people always had some sort of meaning in their lives, and they didn't really have to do their own search for meaning. And if they did, it was very rare. But now those traditional meaning structures are breaking down in a really major way, at least in Western countries. And so people are having this crisis where suddenly they don't have this external meaning structure and they're completely lost.
It is breaking down in the East too. Like you could see that when we were living in Thailand or Vietnam or, you know, any of those places in Southeast Asia, at least you could see, especially in urban centers, a very Westernized mode of being. Like it's like their base operating system, like their DOS or Windows 95 had Buddhism and Eastern philosophy pre-installed, but then that all got wiped clean with the Western Windows 98 and on. Do you know what I mean? Like the standard operating procedure now seems to be a lot more Western centric. So it's like, it's kind of a global phenomenon if you're of a younger generation.
Western centric and also secular, which is problematic because the secular operating system doesn't include very large chunks of human experience that can't be explained by secular thought.
Expand on that.
Okay, so for example, can't remember where I saw this, but a very large percentage of the population have had some sort of a mystical experience. Right. It's actually extremely common. And that just seems to be part of being human. It's not, you know, a glitch or a pathology like the secular system tries to portray it as, or just dismiss it entirely.
Or the devil speaking to you.
Well, that would be the religious framework, but the secular framework would just dismiss it or say it's some sort of a glitch in the brain, you know, neurons misfiring.
Yeah, I got mixed up with secular and what's the opposite of secular? What's the
religious?
Religious. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Secular just means like atheist, non-religious.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, definitely there's more of this sort of materialist mechanistic view of consciousness and the experiences of consciousness and not really taking into account mystical. I hate even labeling it as mystical, but just sort of those standard, like I call the person I'm thinking about and they call me at the same time. Like everyone's got that experience of that synchronistic event. These sort of like non-local, apparently higher dimensional or non-material happenings that everyone has experience with. Coincidences that just are too, the chance of happening are too rare to actually just be chance.
But it's extremely common.
Mm-hmm.
And very meaningful a lot of the time to people. But within the secular meaning structure, it's dismissed.
Yeah.
It's not explainable. It's not assigned any meaning. So I find that the secular meaning structure, I mean, it was existent for a long time. And it did provide some sort of a stable ground for people. But even now even that is breaking down.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and people are in free fall, essentially, because there isn't a religious foundation. The secular foundation is breaking down.
Free fall wouldn't be so bad. It's more like they're grasping at any ideology, any structure they can to make sense of the world. And they are successfully grabbing onto things and holding onto them. That's part of the problem, right? Like we've always been advocating free fall. And what we've talked about with awakening and personal growth and becoming an adult, it's like you have to become comfortable with ambiguity and feeling like you're falling in the void. Only from that point can you look out at the world and all the chaos and all the lack of sense and actually make sovereign, high sense decisions, you know? But when you are latched onto a framework, which is people are doing it out of a fear response, right? From falling. They're just grasping at anything they can. You look like I've made a new connection.
I just had an insight because I was thinking, you know, as people are falling, they are grasping at meaning structures. But what are the meaning structures that they're grasping at, especially in Western countries? They have to do with trauma and victimhood. So, and then I realized something, because when your kind of top level abstract meaning structures get destroyed, what is underneath all of that in the unconscious? It's trauma. And like when you do your own investigation work, that's the order that it happens. You deconstruct some top level kind of overarching meaning framework, and then what emerges after that is all of your trauma.
Yeah.
And people are grasping onto some sort of meaning structure. So that's the next thing down that they find in their consciousness. And so now that's emerging as the new meaning structure. And so there's all this obsession with people being oppressed or people being victims of something, one thing or another, because they're part of a specific group or they have some sort of a identity or shared life experience that other people have. And I just made that connection and it blew my mind. Because, yeah, like in my own investigation of my own mind, that's the order that it happened.
Yeah. Yeah. To me, that's like, that's, yeah, that has made sense for a while. The falling and grasping at things, like any meaning structure.
But specifically the trauma and victimhood meaning structure that emerges lower down in the unconscious. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So now from my perspective on this, it seems like the grasping is due to a fear of the free fall, right? Which is related to the fear of turning around and facing those things you're afraid to look at, right? The unconscious sort of animal elements of us, or the trauma, as you've said. So but let's also talk about that a bit.
It's a fear of uncertainty as well, in general. Yeah. A fear, and deeper down, a fear of no self. A fear of not having an identity at all.
That's a big jump. Let's unpack that a bit. Because the no self thing, I mean, we talk about this, but we got to make that connection.
Sure.
And let's go back a bit to unpack the fear stuff first.
Okay. Fear of uncertainty. Yeah. Like people are grasping for certainty.
Yeah. Yeah. So the uncertainty thing is something we've uncovered a lot in the development of the course, and now the calls seem to be a recurring, not so much actually, people seem to be getting past that a bit and understanding that the future is uncertain and being okay with that. But every once in a while, when a new person comes on the call, it seems like this is like a recurring theme, that the fears of the future and being a young person or having kids or
job prospects.
Yeah.
Or climate change.
Yeah. All of that is due to uncertainty. And, you know, when people ask us about our decision-making, and like, how can we be certain, or how can we make decisions about our future and be confident that they're going to work out? And it's like, why would you make that decision? How can you know that it's going to work out? And really the answer is always the same. It's we don't know, and we're doing it anyway. Like, you don't know, you can't have certainty. And the only thing that the desire for certainty does is paralyze you.
Yeah.
That's essentially it.
I was thinking actually about this yesterday, how the desire for certainty, especially in today's chaotic world, can actually make you a slave and really impair you.
Yeah, because other people know this and can take advantage of it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. When people are confused, there's always some sort of leader who is, you know,
offering certainty.
strong man who is happy to offer certainty at the cost of your sovereignty.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, people keep looking for that. Even you could tell them straight to their face everything we've just discussed now, and they're going to keep insisting, well, I need guidance, I need hand holding, I need something, like someone needs to show me and hold space for me. Really, this is something that I tried to get across in the call. It's not vital, it's not critical that you have that. There are so many people who are isolated, and I count myself among one of them, having gone through like a period of darkness and isolation and having to learn what we've taught recently and kind of come out the other side of nihilism, appreciating the world, understanding that things are ambiguous and that's okay. There's nothing that I can do about that or should do about it. And I can keep living my life without that certainty. Like, what I mean to say is you can find a light at the end of the tunnel, and you can escape nihilism, and you can be comfortable with that uncertainty
and
without the support network, without the handholding, without a shamanic experience. Like,
well, you can be your own shaman. That's the thing.
I mean, you can do psychedelics alone in a dark room, like Terrence McKenna's always talked about.
But you can also do it without psychedelics, just if you're doing any kind of personal transformation work. This actually was brought up on the call by somebody else, that the rites of passage and the initiations that young men specifically went through in tribal societies, we really don't have them in our society today, but that's exactly what they taught you. They taught you how to find your own center, how to transition from being reliant on the tribe to being self-reliant, how to become your own authority, how to find your own North Star, your own center to being self-guided, essentially. Yeah. And this was absolutely necessary for men in tribal societies, because then they would be able to have other people rely on them instead of relying on others. And it doesn't mean that you suddenly become this like selfish person that doesn't need anyone. That's not the case at all. You just gain your sovereignty, and then you're able to be a rock for other people. You're able to hold space for others when they're sick, or, you know, children, or like pregnant women who are, you know, who need protection.
What I'm trying to understand is the desire for guidance and to be shown the way, because this is something I struggle to relate to because of the entrepreneurship background that I have. Like, and I think I know entrepreneurs will relate to this. Like, it's all about carving your own path. It's like I've become the most unemployable person, I think, at this point, because I'm just so used to doing things the way I want and dealing with the uncertainty of the ambiguity of my decisions and in whether or not things are going to work out. I'm just like, yeah, that's the way my life has been. It's been that way for so long that I don't know anything else. I don't know certainty. So what I think is probably a very healthy thing to start thinking about is, what sort of entrepreneurial direction can you take your life into? Don't you think?
Even like, if it's not starting your own business, it's like, how can you become an entrepreneur of your own mind?
I suppose, but there's something about entrepreneurship where you are taking control of the material destiny of your life. Like the literal outcome of everything around you, your success on a very material sense. Like that, you're in real danger.
Yeah.
If you fuck that up. So, I mean, that's... people are coming at this sort of spiritual work at a very material level, right? Like there's a lot of, if you ask most people what they're afraid of, it would be not having enough money, my safety in the near future. It's very like on Maslow's hierarchy of needs, it's very at like the bottom two rungs, right?
It's also like being ostracized, not being respected, not fulfilling my destiny, being alone.
Yeah. But I still think the entrepreneurship element is really it's a really good training for the bottom system. It's training for probably all of them, but, you know, taking full responsibility for your own physical well-being and the well-being if you have a family as well, like to take that big risk. And there's so much mental training and resilience training that you have to go through in order to get through that.
I agree with you. I think that's just a very hard pill to swallow for a lot of people. And it's not something that you can really prescribe, because most of the time, it's just easier for people to have a job. It's because it is such a hard path, full of failure and risk and uncertainty. And, you know, it's not something that you can just do. Like, if you want to find a better job, like, maybe you look for a while and then eventually you find it and then you switch. But it's not at all like that with entrepreneurship. Like, it could be years, decades before you make it, or before you're even able to support yourself properly. Like, you know, we hear about these success stories in the news, you know, some entrepreneur being profiled, and we have this idea that it's just like overnight success, but it's not like that. So I think it's definitely, if people are able to take on entrepreneurship as a lifestyle, then it will definitely be very valuable for them in other ways, because it literally retrains your brain.
Yeah.
It retrains you to be more sovereign in a bunch of different ways that you probably didn't even expect.
Yeah. Yeah. And the expansion and the fruits of those efforts afterwards are also related to your own cognitive sovereignty and especially due to your agency. Like, it's hard to do the exploration work and the growth work that we're talking about when you're stuck in that 9-to-5. And that's like, you're always month to month trying to make ends meet. Like, it's really hard to escape from that sort of system when you are dependent on someone else for your income. So, I mean, that's the only way I feel like most of my growth has been able to happen, is through having control over my finances and my
time,
especially time, because our finances have never been like amazing, but the time element to just be have the freedom to step back and read a book or do some meditation.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, it's been the biggest thing.
So we had talked about we unpacked the fear a little bit, and there was something else that you were gonna go into after this.
Sure. Well, I was talking about the fear of no self, a fear of not having an identity. And that's a very deep fear that tends to surface when when your identity crumbles for whatever reason. For some people, they might be heavily identified with their job or their role in a relationship. And when for whatever reason that ends, they have an identity crisis. They don't know who they are anymore. And in every crisis is an opportunity to grow. That's something that has been a recurring theme for me, that the worst thing that happens to you is the biggest opportunity to grow.
Yeah.
And it's the same with this, you know, because when people have an identity crisis, they start grasping for some other identity, you know, on falling on the way down. But just allowing yourself to fall and not having an identity, just it's actually there's huge freedom in that, in just not being anyone, even just for a few moments, just, you know, sitting in meditation and not having to be anyone for it, not having to be anyone or anything
for anyone or anything
for anyone. Yeah.
Yeah. There's something about the fear of no self that to me seems wrapped up in Eastern philosophy, kind of Buddhism. That, and I want to take it a little bit more towards an evolutionary context, like the fear of death.
It really relates to the fear of death. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's not much more than that, is it? Like, and so many fears kind of come down to that.
But it's not just the fear of death, physical death. It's also the fear of the death of your memory. Like, basically, I can't remember who said this, but contemplate the moment that you are thought of for the last time.
That's a good one. Yeah, everyone's memory fades eventually.
So when the collective memory of your existence is completely gone, so you're not only physically gone, you're also gone out of the consciousness of the human organism.
Yeah. There was something I remember when I was a kid and contemplating religion and spirituality and life after death and all of this stuff. And I remember someone saying, I think I was like, I watched The Lion King when that came out in 95 or something. And I was thinking like, you know, Mufasa says to Simba, everything continues in the circle of life. When the lions die, their bodies become the grass, the antelope eat the grass. And so it's okay. Everything is a cycle. And I thought about that. I was like, well, that sucks, because what about my memory and my individuality and what makes me me? Like, it doesn't, to me, I thought at the time, it doesn't matter if my body feeds something else, if I'm gone. Like, that's not solace for me. And then from other contexts of different religions, I suppose you could say Buddhism, like what, why would it matter if you didn't have, if you weren't you after death, you know, if you just shed all the things that make you you. But now, so many years later, I realize you forget so much anyway, and you still are you, and you still are you with a personality in the depths of the void that we're talking about in meditation. Like, you're still a witnessing presence if you're meditating and able to kind of quiet down the thoughts, the constant chatter of the monkey mind. If you can quiet that down for long enough, you still are witnessing. And that's actually far more blissful than the stories of what you believe makes you you, all of the memories, all of the things, all the connections that you have. Like, those things were just experiences that you had in the moment at some point in time. They're just you experiencing something, and you've latched onto them as stories because you like them. You put them in boxes of that was good or that was bad. But I find if you ever like, if you ever go back and talk to family about some event that happened, people compartmentalize it in completely different ways, right? They rewrite that memory and they put a label on it. Like, that was a good experience. Our family trip to wherever, Disneyland, was like, that was an amazing thing. And one of the kids just had a miserable time and has put a completely different label on that thing. But really, the whole experience in reality was probably just kind of middle ground, mediocre, like any other day. Yeah, the car ride sucked, and then some of the rides were great. Then I puked on that ride and that sucked. And then, we, you know, whatever.
And then the lineup was 12 hours long.
Nothing's ever like this good, awesome, and this bad, terrible. It's like there's all, most experiences are kind of middle ground, but then we put labels on them and then we build that into our identity. And that's something like, well, that makes me me. I don't want to let go of that memory. But what I'm trying to say is like, there's more value in the experiential moment, mm-hmm. right? I know I'm going on a long rant here, but so anyway, long story short, I came to the conclusion that I don't give a shit about the memories. Like I could, as long as I'm present, those memories will be a lot better anyway. If I'm present in the moment and being happy in the moment, those memories will always be better anyway. And I'll remember them for what they were instead of labeling them as something different later. Or at least I'll have a closer representation of what they are.
Do you mean memories or new experiences that you're going to have?
Memories. So experiences that I'm having that get turned into memories.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, I feel like I've made a very convoluted way of saying like the stories of your identity are illusory and not that valuable.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that's going to just irk people who are really identified with their identities, but I do think there's far less suffering in letting go of the identity and being in the present moment without that identity in your day-to-day interactions with people, in how you behave in work and life and with your spouse and everything. So it's like, I want to loop this back now to the fact that there's so much identity politics and like fragmenting of identities in what you see with the green SJW sort of level of development that we see in the West. Can you expand on that for me?
You're talking about spiral dynamics, yeah. Green stage of development. So we haven't done an episode on spiral dynamics, which we probably should.
Let's do that next.
Yeah, let's do that next.
But we can still expand on that and then just go watch the next one when we're done. But
it's the pluralist, anti-hierarchy, kind of earth-centric. All points are valid.
Yeah.
Trying to...
Everything's a social construct.
Yeah, belief in social constructs. And there's a lot of truth to all
of
those things.
Yeah, I know I should talk it a lot, but it's not all bad. Like, there's a lot of really high-level developmental thinking going on there. But it's really the trouble of... See, what they're doing, and this is the point I was trying to make, is they're trying to discard identities such as gender. Gender's a big one right now. Let's discard identity of gender. Like, if I want to be a girl, I can act like a girl, and that's fine, and everyone should accept that, and vice versa. If I want to express in one way and have an orientation, sexual orientation in another way, like, all sort of labels that I would define myself as should be okay. The problem is this fragmenting of identity and the latching on to the different identities is a way to self-express and signal to the world your special uniqueness. That's really the problem, because you're offloading some identities, or there's a weird contradiction there where it's like you're getting rid of an identity, but you're also building it into yourself a lot more strongly.
It's, again, the same thing where your top-level meaning structure collapses, which is, say, gender identity or traditional gender roles. And then you start falling and then you start grasping onto the next thing to try to reconstruct a new identity. So you don't complete that deconstruction process, actually.
But
you just stuck on the way down. So instead of having a traditional gender identity, you then construct some sort of a fancy new gender identity and try to operate from that.
Right. So, yeah, the fragmentation of self-expression. Do you think it's because people feel like there's not enough ability to express within more simple, rigid definitions of identity? Like, they don't want to be confined to an identity, so they want to branch off and express in another way? I feel like there's some relation to that. Like, it probably doesn't define the whole experience, but I do think that is an element of it.
I'm not sure if this is exactly it, but something that comes up for me, it's like people are seeking freedom from traditional gender identity, traditional religious structures, but then they don't complete that search for freedom, because freedom is in being fluid, like not gender fluid as an identity, but actually just being whatever you are, and yes, being comfortable with it and accepting it and not trying to force anything.
Yeah, it's the label that kind of trips people up.
Like, yeah, it's the label the needing, that fucks it up.
Yeah, the needing of that label, and then the label being the thing that defines you instead of you defining the set of labels that you would like to have, which is irrelevant anyway. You don't need the labels to begin with.
So it's
discard, like, them all.
It's like you escape the big prison and then you build a prison for yourself. You know, you escape the societally prescribed identity and then you build your own identity. Yeah,
and it's more confining than the previous one.
Yeah, it's smaller and more confining.
Yeah. So the identity is really the big thing.
Mm-hmm.
Discarding and deconstructing the identity, everything that makes you you. And the freedom that comes with that.
The ideas about, you know, I am this way, or I'm this kind of person, or I identify as this. Just, you don't need that. Just be whatever you are.
Yeah. Yeah. What is, so I imagine people asking the question, well, what is left? Like, how would I express? Like, how dare you tell me to throw that stuff off and then I'd just be nothing?
But it's not about being nothing. It's about being everything. Everything that you are, without having to put it in a box.
That's a good way of saying it. Yeah.
Not worrying
about how society would define you either. Like, who gives a shit?
Who cares? By putting yourself in a box, you're actually cutting off parts of yourself that don't fit into this neatly, you know, packaged thing.
Yeah.
Because, like, one day you might feel one way, another day you might feel another way. So how do you define that? You don't have to. Just be. So let's loop it back to sovereignty.
Yeah.
So, okay, here's the thing that comes up. So somebody might have an objection. How can you have sovereignty if you don't have an identity?
Yeah.
Because those two things are often kind of tied together. Well, sovereignty is a capacity that you have. It's a capacity for how you act in the world, for how you perceive, for how you make sense. It's has something to do with being, with the function of being, not with the function of how you define yourself. It actually has nothing to do with that.
There's a critical element in this of how you look at your life and how you find freedom by disidentifying with every one of those labels you've given yourself. By putting everything on, I like to say, the chopping block, where all of your identities or all of your ideas or all of your concepts about the world can now be examined as if they are not you, because they're not you. And that's why this is so valuable to sovereignty, is because you are logically looking at everything that you previously believed that makes up your identity, and you're picking it apart and you're putting it on the chopping board to be dissected and examined and to find the conclusion of whether that thing serves you to begin with, and then to discard it completely if it doesn't, because it doesn't define you. It's just something, it's like a mask you can wear.
So yeah, there's that aspect. And it's actually something really interesting that was brought up in the call today, is there's this kind of intellectual deconstruction or cognitive deconstruction that you can do. But there's also another piece that's very valuable, and that's just kind of the intuitive feeling into something. And so there's this aspect of sovereignty that's just like intuitively feeling yourself into a space where you feel clarity, where you feel agency. And that's more of a feminine aspect, as it was described in the call. But I think it is very valuable, because you can listen to your body, actually. And you can listen to your body for clues of how you feel about a situation. And you can notice when you're losing sovereignty by how your body is responding. I found this really valuable. So, for example, if you feel your palms sweating, heart rate elevating, you feel this knot in your stomach, like, that's your body telling you something's not right. You better, you know, pay more attention to what's happening.
That part I don't understand so much. Like, I think you're right about the feminine masculine difference there. Like, I don't understand the feminine intuition so much. I do deeply understand the logical deconstruction aspect, which is why I brought that up.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to expand more on one of those?
Well, we did an episode about logical deconstruction that we'll link to in the show notes here that I think explained it quite well. But I actually wanted to go back to the point about sovereignty relating to identity, how they seem to be kind of part of the same thing. You know, self, because often there's self-sovereign. That's the term that is used. And it's actually now used to describe certain things in technology where like self-sovereign identity or, you know, self-sovereign bank account or self-sovereign Bitcoin wallet or whatever. Like nobody has control of it except for you. So I want to untie this idea of self from the idea of sovereignty. And this is why I brought up the feeling, because sovereignty is a capacity that has to do with being. It has nothing to do with your self or identity. Does that make sense?
Yes. I think it needs more expansion, though.
It's like, in this case, we're talking about sovereignty as a process.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I get it. It's not something you are, it's something you use.
Something you do.
Yeah.
Or be.
The perception, yeah, okay. I still think it's something you do.
You do, yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, this is an interesting point, that being and doing are actually the same thing. They're part of the same multidimensional object, yeah. Higher dimensional object.
That's okay, that's way too off in the spaceland to go into now. But I think it makes a lot of sense to say it's something you do.
I'll explain that very quickly, actually, because I've thought about this quite a lot. So being and becoming are the same thing, but just being is like a snapshot from like a one frame of the film, and becoming is the whole film.
Ah.
But they are the same thing, essentially. It just depends on how closely you want to observe it. Do you want to observe it as like a snapshot in time or like all of time existing simultaneously?
So B is the snapshot, becoming is the whole thing?
Yeah.
Okay.
Becoming is the process and B is the snapshot, but they're part of the same thing.
Okay.
Yeah. So, but it is something that you're becoming. It's something that you're doing. It's a process. Like, you are perceiving something. You are making sense of something. You are acting on something.
Yeah.
So the interesting bit about this being and becoming thing is that being is the snapshot, right? At one moment in time, you could say, I am this right now. And so people take that, whatever that is, and then make a rigid identity of it, not realizing that it's a process that keeps unfolding. You are becoming, you are right. In flow, like that being, whatever you are in that moment, is always changing, right?
Yeah. It reminds me of, I think the term is state-dependent memory.
Mm.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Like where you know, depending on the state of mind or the emotional state you're in, you end up having a completely different experience of the world.
Mm.
You even call up different memories than you have access to normally. You and I have discussed this quite a bit about how being in a certain state, like being grumpy or something, will call up all kinds of different memories. Like, and just solving the emotional state before you work on the problem that is the subject of the emotional state is the way to have a productive conversation.
Yeah, and this totally relates to sovereignty, because in order to have clarity of perception, you need to get yourself to an emotionally neutral state. And that's one of the main thing that messes up clarity of perception, is being in a out of whack emotionally. And that's either being too excited or too angry or too depressed. Like, it could be positive or negative, but it will always color your experience and how you're perceiving the world. And so this is why equanimity is so important, to cultivate equanimity, like to be able to return to a neutral state.
I think also in recognizing that you're not perfect at that either, if you think you're, you know, you get calm, like you still have that state dependent memory and experience of life. And you have to recognize that, like, you are all, your experience right now is only a small slice of your possible modes of being, all the possible options of the ways you could feel or think or
yeah,
any of those things. And that the way you feel right now is not the way you always are. And you woke up a completely different person than the one who's existing right now and the one who will go to bed later tonight.
Yeah, there's an expression that goes, you never walk into the same river twice. Mm. And that's exactly it. You're never the same person again after whatever kind of slice moment of your life that you choose to define yourself, you're never that person again, because life keeps unfolding.
So I do really think that that labeling thing is a critical point about this, like recognizing being and becoming from the identity you give to yourself, the roles and the labels you give to yourself, which is why I'm such an advocate of not dispensing with the labels altogether, not even bothering with them. Like, don't define yourself. Don't feel the need to define yourself to others as a way to signal something. Just like, be what you are, be authentically you without the labels. And that will actually give you a lot more access to, I would say, sovereignty.
Yeah, it does give you a lot more access to sovereignty, for sure. Because then you're not in a box, you're not constricted.
Yeah.
And so on a practical note, people might be like, okay, well then how do I talk about myself? And so there's kind of a few things to say about that. Well, first, you could talk about yourself less.
Yeah. Whoa. That's crazy. Let's not do that.
You could just do. And then the second thing, if you do have to talk about, you know, if somebody asks you a direct question, you could talk about it in terms of what you do rather than what you are.
Exactly. Like, that's exactly what I was thinking. Disown yourself from the things you call yourself. Like,
yeah.
Instead of I am this, say I do this.
Yeah.
I like to do this currently, you know.
I do a podcast.
Yeah. I'm not a podcaster. That does not define me.
Mm-hmm.
You know. I'm not my race. I'm not my gender. I'm not my sexual orientation. I'm not my job. I'm not my khakis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that great line from Fight Club.
Yeah. Everything we've talked about today is covered in our course in Sovereignty, which you can find at courses.futurethinkers.org. The calls we've discussed are ongoing every week. There's something you can get access to as well. And I think we can probably wrap it up here, right?
Mm-hmm.
Anything else you want to wrap up with about sovereignty?
Yeah. I think that sovereignty is becoming more and more relevant in our times, in part because of the factors that we talked about, that the world is becoming more chaotic. People's meaning structures and identity structures are crumbling. And sovereignty is how they can operate in this world more effectively without getting swept up into something.
An ideology or
some sort of a political system that tries to control them, or just being in a unpleasant state and not being able to make sense of anything, not being able to make decisions. You know, being in a perpetual state of outrage, that's just not fun.
Yeah. Yeah, it isn't. Yeah, a lot of the states that these different meme tribes put you into are not healthy, not productive, don't feel good. They don't feel good to other people you're trying to recruit either. And the whole thing is just kind of one-dimensional and boxing in, very isolating.
Yeah, but they serve a purpose. They provide an identity and a meaning structure.
Yeah.
So if you can deconstruct, you know, having the need for an external meaning structure and an externally defined identity, then you can actually be more sovereign.
Did we expand enough on the meaning crisis, or do you want to just do that in another time?
Another one, yeah. Actually, we're going to... there's a great lecture series by John Vervaeke. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. It's very, very long. I think it's at 20 hours currently, and it's going to be at 50 hours when it's done. We'll link to it in the show notes. And it talks about the meaning crisis that we're going through right now. And it takes kind of a very multi-prong approach to it, from mythology, anthropology, you know, what's happening in the world right now. It's really, really interesting. I think you guys will like it.
From the way it sounds so far, and I've only listened to a couple of them, it sounds like he's going through all the different steps of the spiral dynamic stages. Like, he's kind of defining the lower stages through stories and then telling the next stage. So I have a feeling he's going to go through all of that. I don't know for sure, but...
Yeah, I've noticed that pattern as well. I don't know if... I don't think he's explicitly mentioned it. But the interesting thing is that spiral dynamic stages also parallel the stages of human evolution.
Yeah.
But they also parallel the stages of individual evolution from childhood to adulthood.
And societal.
And societal, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah. So you mentioned him because we've signed up to do an interview with him, right?
Yeah, we're going to do an interview with him shortly. Cool. So that's going to be fun.
Yeah, that will be. Yeah. So we've got that coming up. We're going to talk about meme tribes and the meaning crisis in the future. And I think probably the next one we're going to do is about spiral dynamics. And actually, we could link in the meme tribes to that one too, because we did that in the course. So we can probably expand on that. That one's a lot of fun. The idea is that you're looking out at the different meme tribes that exist. And this can be like the intellectual dark web or social justice warrior movement, or I mean, name a couple others. I can't think of a whole lot.
Antifa.
Yeah.
Incels. Yeah.
Yeah, there's, we actually have a huge spreadsheet that we have mapped out all the different spiral dynamic levels to of all of the different meme tribes that exist today. And the spreadsheet is fantastic. If you're interested in learning more about meme tribes, it's just like, it's so thorough. All of the different, we found it from that article.
Peter Lindbergh, and I can't remember the name of the other guy. I'm really sorry, but we will link to it actually in the show notes.
Yeah, go to the show notes of this episode. There's going to be a ton of links. And that article with from Peter Lindbergh, I think, is a fantastic article about the meaning crisis and about meme tribes. It's awesome. We based so much content in one of our lessons on that article. So yeah, interesting stuff. Go to the show notes at futurethinkers.org/97. Cool. See you in the next one.
Bye. Okay, bye. Thanks for tuning in to Future Thinkers. For all the books, resources, and mentions from this episode, go to futurethinkers.org/97. And if you want to stay up to date with our latest episodes, blog posts, or news from Future Thinkers, join our mailing list at futurethinkers.org/mailing-list. To meet like-minded people, join our Future Thinkers Discord community. Go to futurethinkers.org/discord.
Check out our new course in personal evolution. Part one is on cultivating sovereignty and is designed to support you in developing more clarity about your direction and purpose in life, making better decisions, and having more agency to live your life on your own terms.
Part 2 is on integrating the shadow and is designed to support you in overcoming nihilism and tapping into an inner source of energy, creativity, and wisdom to make meaningful progress towards actualizing your full potential. To learn more, go to courses.futurethinkers.org. Don't forget to subscribe and hit the bell icon to get notified of new videos. You can also follow us on social media to stay connected. If you'd like to get a t-shirt like the new Make America Think Again, go to futurethinkers.org/store. If you like what we do and you want to help us make more podcasts and videos, consider donating or becoming a patron at futurethinkers.org/support. Also visit our sponsor Qualia and use the coupon code FUTURE to get 10% off your purchase.